This is Deanna Spingola. This is Thursday, July 19th, 2012, and this is one of my special interviews. We have no commercials, no censorship, no calls, and no music. It is just education and information. It is bare bones broadcasting. My guest today is Father Matthew Raphael Johnson. He is the author of The Third Rome, Holy Russia, Tsarism, and Orthodoxy, and other books. People know him as the Orthodox Nationalist, excuse me, and he has a radio program on Voice of Reason Radio Network. Welcome to the program.
Thank you for having me on. I appreciate it.
And I listened to one of your wonderful programs. It was about Hegelian dialecticals, and I was just very fascinated with it because I'd written some things about it and totally misunderstood it in the way that you explained it.
Well, that's not entirely uncommon. I know, as I've said on other shows, Hegel is the most difficult of all the philosophers to read. I don't think there's anyone who would argue that. He has his own vocabulary, and if you don't know what he means prior to you picking up the book and reading, you're not going to understand anything that he says. I think that not only is Hegel not an opponent of ours, but in fact is one of the more conservative thinkers of the early part of the 19th century. And I did my master's thesis on the philosophy of right, which was his last major work, primarily on political theory. The concept of dialectics was taken by those who came after Hegel, Ludwig Feuerbach in particular, and his student Karl Marx. And I think from that moment on, it took the negative point of view that I mean, well, what you said isn't incorrect. It's just that you can't attribute it to Hegel.
Correct. Right. The same principle applies. It just has been misused and attributed to him. Where in fact, you know, the solution reaction. What Icke says, David Icke says it. He says there's a problem, and then the government gives you a solution, one that they had kind of designed beforehand, and then the public is ready to accept something because of the problem itself. So it's just very interesting, and of course, many people attribute it to him, when in fact, it isn't appropriate to do so.
Yeah. Well, his main work that I spent many years on, The Philosophy of Right, is a way to ground the human person in a conservative social order. He's defending the general political development in early 19th century Prussia, where he's from. And what he's trying to do is do what Burke did a generation before, just putting it on a both a metaphysical and psychological footing. But because he's so inaccessible, including to professionals, that people just don't know what he's saying. I mean, it took me years to master the first half of the phenomenology of spirit. You know, he uses words like force and concept, and we think that we know what those words mean. But when you read it in his context, we have no idea. And so you have to have someone kind of take you through it. But I think what you're talking about is the non-naive approach to politics, where we don't think in linear terms. We have to think in dialectical terms. We have to remember that the system controls not only its friends, but also its opposition. That's the way that you're using it. And of course, I say that you have to think in those terms.
Okay.
I know you've said that in the past, that, you know, the system not only manifests those forces that are in favor of it, but also controls much of its opposition as well. Now, that's dialectical thinking, and that's, you know, I think it's very naive to say that everyone who opposes the system is, in fact, independent of the system. Controlling your opposition is a way to institutionalize debate that, in fact, is totally harmless to you.
Right. Okay. Yeah, I wrote about this in my first book, my first political book, but just listening to that radio program you did, I mean, I hung on every word, and I'm thinking, oh my goodness, did I have this just just did not apply it correctly. And you actually did, you actually studied his words, his book, you understood what he said. And of course, anybody looking into the German language to begin with, they have a whole different way of expressing themselves. And unless you have a background in that kind of thought, you're not going to understand what they're saying to begin with, correct?
Well, for example, when Hegel uses the word state, he's being very technical. I think we normally use the word state to refer to a government, coercive agencies, coercive offices. When Hegel uses it, he's actually referring to not only those things, but the entire cultural and ethnic mentality that surrounds and gives meaning to those things. So even in a simple word like that, we think that we know what he means. He means the word in a far more expansive, far more cultural mentality. Corporation is another one. He uses corporation in a much older context to refer to something along the lines of a guild or a labor union. Even words like phenomenology. I mean, the fact that we instill meanings into things that we think are external to us, but in fact say as much about us as it does about the things that are out there. I told on that the show that you're making reference to, with what's his name, that guy from Australia, I said you could kind of understand Hegel by simply saying that there is no such thing as an individual. There is only context, but that context also includes our own will. And that's really the simplest way I could possibly put it.
Okay. That is interesting. Now, and of course, we also know, or at least I understand, that Engels and some of the people that I associate with Marx also studied Hegel's philosophy, and so that automatically puts Hegel into a negative light, because if you have people like that who are studying him, you think, well, gosh, is he the source of some of these horrific mentalities or these horrific kind of concepts that we've been saddled with?
Well, what Karl Marx said relative to the philosophy of right and his commentary on the philosophy of right is that Hegel was wrong. Hegel was wrong because he viewed everything through a spiritual lens. Karl Marx says, no, you have to view everything through a materialist lens. So he took the method but completely substituted the content to refer to technology and methods of production rather than the human will and the soul, which is what Hegel's concern was.
Oh, I see. Okay. So basically he used it, but he just altered it. Because, of course, Engels and Marx were certainly not a part of the same spiritual mentality that Hegel apparently was.
Yeah, I mean, they were vehemently opposed to him, but they did think that he was brilliant, at least in the sense that he laid out a method that they could use to justify their point of view in talking about how classes form. I don't necessarily think that classes are totally irrelevant either, but making them the centerpiece of your philosophy is another matter. But in both cases, they did have one thing in common, though, and that is that they didn't believe that individuals existed. Not just individuals as in you and me, but individuals as objects in nature. Those are more or less arbitrary understandings, having more to do with what we want to do with them rather than how we actually understand them. So they did agree that the individual has to be understood in context before you know anything. They did probably also agree on the fact that history matters, that whenever we make a judgment on something, we are speaking with the force of our particular historical environment. And it's, we do not see things the same way that someone 1,000 years ago will see them. So they both agree on those two points. But as far as what they were using those points for, it's a totally different matter. I mean, Karl Marx said that Hegel was a reactionary conservative, but at least he had the logic down and the logic straight.
Okay. Yeah, and also Engels and Marx also studied Weishaupt and Illuminism and that kind of thing.
And how
How did they apply Hegel's philosophy to the study of Illuminism, or did they?
I don't think that there's an immediate connection. Hegel was a professional historian as well as a professional philosopher. He was a professor. And so I'm not saying that even Hegel may not have borrowed certain things from the Eastern tradition. I know there's a book out claiming that a lot of what Hegel did is coming from the from the tradition of Buddhism and Hinduism. I don't know if that's completely true or not, but I'm pretty certain that you can use Hegel in a strictly orthodox way and make sense out of him. You can't do that with Marx and Engels.
Okay. So where did the order out of chaos come from? Is that something that Marx took and applied to his, what he was trying to do?
Well, I think it has more to do with alchemy. I think we can go all the way back to Babylon and to understand that the establishment at the time can use a chemical like quicksilver to break down the components of anything, that could take any piece of matter in the world and break it down into its components, and therefore can put it back together in any way they want. Like Michael Hoffman, I also agree that alchemy had more to do with political theory than it did with metals and matter. But the point is that the alchemical idea is that nature should be at the behest of the human scientific establishment. If we know what objects are made of, we can split it up into its components and then put it back together any way we want. If you apply that concept to politics, you have order out of chaos.
Oh, certainly. And of course, that's where they they incorporated Masonic dogma into their idea of a new world order.
Yeah, I think so. Yeah. Yeah. Remember, the one thing that all Masons agree on is that matter is eternal, that matter is, in fact, God. And when you take the real radical Darwinian point of view, everything that could possibly exist already exists in matter. It's just a matter for the evolutionary process to work it all out, to work out all the conflicts and work out all of the issues that matter has. And then what it has potentially, it will have actually. When I first read The Origin of the Species, I was struck by two things. Number one, that he seems to be taking his point of view from the point of view of British capitalism. Number two, that matter is God. That matter contains potentially everything. And it's just a matter for the historical and the evolutionary process to tease it all out.
Okay. Yeah, it's very interesting because when you look at Freemasonry, you see that a lot of people, well, for instance, in the military, a lot of the high-ranking Freemasons have very large jobs, that, like they're generals in the military, and they are basically in charge of a lot of destruction on the planet. And so it would kind of fit into this thing with order out of chaos, that so they go in and destroy a lot of stuff, and then they go in and rebuild it. Is that what they're am I getting that right?
Well, yeah, but it really depends on the circumstances. I mean, I was against this war in the Middle East. I was against this war in the early 90s. Never mind today. I never thought that people like Assad and Saddam Hussein were particularly bad leaders under the circumstances. And I think that they both inherited a political circumstance from British and French colonialism and struggled with every fiber of their being to hold together a country that is more or less artificial, that they did not create, in a social system that they did not create. I think attacking Iraq was essential as far as that group is concerned, because Saddam Hussein was on the verge of creating a first world economy in the same way that the Koreans did and that the Taiwanese did. Took a third world country in a relatively short period of time, created a first world country. He needed to be knocked out of the way. And now with this stupid thing in Bulgaria, I haven't read about this in any detail, but as soon as this bomb blows up, these Israeli tourists get killed, they immediately say it must be the Iranians.
Yes, is that ridiculous or what? I saw pictures on the TV, and I'm thinking, okay, but what about all the Palestinian slaughter going on? Why don't we ever see that on TV? And of course, I thought, okay, this is a false flag. Probably the Mossad went in there and blew up the bus to begin with, because that's the way they act. That's the way the tactics that they have always used.
That's right. And the country now, Iraq, is infinitely worse off than it was 25 years ago.
Oh, absolutely.
When I first read about the bomb in Bulgaria, I said to myself, why, and if I were the Iranian president, the last thing in the world I would do is do something to anger and trigger anything from Israel or the U.S. And this is tailor-made for them. The Iranians, just like as far as 9/11 goes, the Islamic world has nothing to gain and everything to lose by this kind of tactic. I don't buy it. I remember September 11th, I was working for Willis Cardo at the time, and John Tiffany and I were listening to it on the radio, and they blamed Osama bin Laden for this about 15 minutes after the planes hit.
Right.
Between
I remember.
15 and 20 minutes. There was no analysis. It just was automatic, no different than this thing in Bulgaria. It's automatically someone connected with whoever our enemy happens to be at the moment.
Right. And basically, you can go back and say the same thing about Kristallnacht back in November of 1938. I mean, that would have been the very worst thing that Hitler could have done was to go after the Jews on this particular night. And you have to think, okay, what really happened there? Because that was the very, very worst thing. It made Germany look terrible. And of course, they used it appropriately. You know, their enemies used it appropriately. And
yes.
Just about every other event that you can imagine, you have to look behind the curtain and say, well, who really did this?
But that's what I meant before by thinking dialectically. When you think in terms of normal Anglo-American linear logic, you know, you say, okay, the Iranians hate Americans for no reason. And they hate the Israelis for no good reason. And so whenever they get a chance, they're going to blow up these people. That's a very simple, linear way of looking at the world. The dialectical way is to understand that if you control the process, you control the outcome. They need some event, some terror event that's going to galvanize Israeli opinion, American opinion, British opinion into making war on this humongous country. And this may just be the first of a number of them. But for anyone to think that this is in the interest of the Iranians is out of their mind. This is the last thing that they would want to do. This is the last thing would be to increase the contempt that the Israeli government, who has about 400 nuclear weapons, angrier at them. It makes no sense to me.
Right. And of course, whenever anybody is killed, it reminds me, too, of the Lusitania, where Churchill said, you know, we need to use live bait, because if Americans are killed on the Lusitania, which they were, I think there were like 129 that were killed, then America is going to become outraged and they will declare war on Germany. It didn't work immediately, but that live bait tactic is certainly very beneficial to the people who are trying to start a war.
Yeah, I was just reading that on your site, actually, just a few minutes ago. And I was thinking about how the British radio instructions to the Lusitania said brought them right to a place where there was a wolf pack waiting for them.
Right.
Usually those ships were on a zigzag pattern, trying to throw off any U-boats following them. They instructed the Lusitania to go in a straight line, making them very, very vulnerable. And, yeah, you know, I agree with you on that 100%. This is how the system works. But something about the order ab chaos thing that always struck me was that it's not just that, you know, you need to break down a society so that you could rebuild it. That's simple enough. But there's also the idea that, psychologically speaking, human beings become suggestible when they're in a crisis.
Sure.
You know, I mean, the more severe it is, the more blood, the more destruction, the more homelessness, whatever it is, people are suggestible. They will look for a savior. They're going to look to the state. They're going to look to whatever powerful institution can help them out of this problem. They become different people. They become very – I remember the first few days after 9/11 being in D.C., hearing – I would go to the Hawk and Dove, the restaurant where I used to – close to where I used to work. And I hear people, the blood curdling, we're going to kill all the Muslims, we're going to kill this, we're going to destroy this, we're going to destroy that. They become animals. They become totally different people because they were already programmed that Osama bin Laden had masterminded this whole thing because he hated America. I mean, that's
right.
The kind of mindlessness, you know, and they were turned into animals. And the war was based on that.
Right. And don't you think the traumatization that we all experienced that day, seeing all of this stuff repeatedly all day long for the next several days, that was all part of a mind control programming, don't you think?
Oh, no question about it. It was professional. It was beautifully done from their point of view. There's no way that you could have proved 10 minutes after the first plane hit that this must have been Osama bin Laden. The whole thing. And then they attack his opponents in Iraq, and I wrote people. I tried to explain to them the Muslims hate Saddam Hussein. He's a secular nationalist.
Right.
He has Christians all over his government. The Shiites in Iraq hate him. I said, to talk about Osama bin Laden and have that have something to do with then attacking again Iraq. I mean, the level of mindlessness, the insulting of the intelligence of people was outrageous. Of course, then I realized that, you know, insulting the intelligences of the Americans is fairly easy to do.
How true. And what about going into Afghanistan? Now, is that the most ridiculous thing? And, of course, that was done immediately. It was in the fall of 01, and that was just simply to save the poppy crop for the next season so they wouldn't lose that growing season. And, I mean, if you just think about it, why would you go into Afghanistan and then 3 years later, 2 years later, in March 19th of 2003, then you go into Iraq. And it's because they had to build their case. You know, they had to build that connection.
Absolutely. And for anyone to think that going into Afghanistan in the way that the Soviets did was in any way going to work. And again, it just shows you the mentality of the people who we're dealing with here. If the Soviet Union was incapable of defeating that resistance, what chance did the Americans have, especially since the Americans are far farther away, farther away than that. So nothing made any sense. The pieces did not hold together. But like you say, with the poppy crop, it could be the interests of the Israelis. The mentality here is absolutely it's elite power. It's elite control. It's all it ever is.
Right. And of course, so many people are so tuned in to the TV, they really don't realize that there are only six corporations, all basically with Jewish interest, six corporations that control everything that you see on TV.
It's a total oligarchy. The news media is very tightly controlled, and I think a brilliant move from the point of view of the establishment was the creation of Fox News.
Oh, they're the worst.
Because then they were able to recreate what a conservative is supposed to be. And what a conservative is supposed to be is what we would call a neoconservative that, frankly, has nothing in common with the much older conservative tradition that we're a part of.
Right. I mean, they're Trotskyites.
Yeah, you wrote that thing. I was reading that actually yesterday on Bill Kristol. They have nothing in common with what conservatism actually is. Nothing conservative would ever be tolerated in actual American political debate. But what they were able to do is they will to control their opposition. They had the neoliberal Clintonites in CNN and the networks, and then they had the neoconservatives in Fox. They're able to control the debate. They can control what arguments are acceptable and what isn't. They can control who gets nominated, who is a front runner, and who isn't.
Right.
You know, I remember in 1992, I was in college at the University of Hartford, and a few friends of mine went up to New Hampshire to work on the Buchanan campaign. And I remember that Buchanan won the New Hampshire primary for the Republicans in February of 92. And when I got home to school after it was over, I watched night after night massive media attack on Pat Buchanan. I watched David Letterman attack him. I've watched all of these people, including, you know, apolitical individuals, suddenly now have to gang up on this guy, because if he's ever the nominee, there's going to be some problems. And he wins this thing. He wins the New Hampshire primary. And so the system goes into full gear, attempting to destroy him. And of course, what came out of it was another member of the neoconservative movement.
Right. It is amazing how they do that. And, well, Lenin said that they would control both sides so that they could create the the result so that they could arrive at the result that they wanted. And that's an old tactic, and they've certainly used it very well, and people don't recognize that that's what they're doing on the TV, that yes, these people control everything, and they have this orchestrated opposition, and people buy into it. They buy into this left and right dialectical and think that, you know, and really it divides the public from really looking at who the culprits are.
Well, let me use an example actually from Lenin's era. When the Bolsheviks took over, one of their first targets was the church. And so from the end of World War I to the end of the Civil War in 1921, from 21 to 25, the Bolsheviks did a bunch of things. First of all, they launched the Cheka against the actual members of the Orthodox Church. They went to prison, they went to the camps, they were shot, whatever it was. But he didn't stop there. Lenin also created two church bodies under his control. The first was called the Living Church, which was a pro-Marxist, so-called Orthodox body that was completely dependent on the Cheka and on military intelligence. And that's fairly well known. What's less well known is that Lenin also created a conservative church group, a group called the Gregorians, named after a Bishop Gregory. And this was his conservative alternative to the Living Church. So the Living Church gets a lot of press, this, you know, fake religious body that Lenin created. But what people forget is that he also created a conservative church body. And it's the three steps forward and two steps back, and that's worth it to them. So he controlled both the left and the right as far as the church was concerned. And this was a method to destroy it from within. So there's a classic example.
Exactly. And the people that he murdered, and I was reading in your book all of the things that they did, and yet where is the museums for all of those millions?
Yeah, that's true. And I couldn't conceivably agree with you any more than that. There's a guy out there, Vladimir Moss, who now has I forget how many volumes now, and he gives it all away for free on his website. A complete analysis of all of the new martyrs of the Bolshevik government. And he goes through hundreds and thousands of individuals, bishops, monks, priests, ordinary people who were arrested for this reason and sent into the camps. And he has a massive amount of documentation on who these people were, why they were executed, why they were sent to the camps. And, you know, I mean, it's a multi-volume work, and very few people outside of a handful of specialists and people who care have any idea of the tens of millions who went to their deaths in the Soviet Union. They do not get museums or TV news reports or this endless list of these Holocaust survivors out there who are treated as saints, and these other people are completely ignored.
Totally. And what was the reason? Well, we know that they wanted to destroy what you refer to as Holy Russia. And Russia was a very unique country. And I haven't finished your book yet because I just got it. But it was very special. And they decided to target Russia first and then Germany. Why do you think that they went after Russia first?
Well, Marx himself made it very clear that he thought that Russia was the very core of the conservative reaction to liberalism. In the revolutions of 1848, it was Tsar Nicholas I that invaded Hungary and overthrew the revolutionary government. Marx was in contact with people like Vera Zasulich and other revolutionaries in Russia. Marx was hoping for a Bolshevik revolution in Russia. I know it's common that he didn't think that Russia was ready for, and this was not true. His letters show otherwise. He was in regular contact with the Russian opposition to the monarchy in the 1840s and 1850s. Marx hated the Russians most of all because he believed that that government was by far the most conservative in Europe, and it should be noted, was, I believe, the only major government in the European powers that did not permit the private banking interests to take over the currency. I believe that Russia was the only one where, coming from the Byzantine idea, the prestige of the royal family is found in the minting of its money.
Right. And, of course, that's one of the first things that they did, was to destroy the royal family and then, of course, make anti-Semitism a felony. It was just very interesting how they did all of that, but all of the millions that they killed, just unbelievable. It's just unbelievable that they could slaughter so many people. And how did they do that?
Well, primarily, I think, was the camp system. The Gulag camp, which was meant to be a re-education facility, actually ended up becoming a substantial part of the Russian economy. I have a show on the Gulag system. I've lectured on it in the past. And these were essentially forced labor camps where you were worked to death. And you were given a certain term where kangaroo court, and you were sent there. That was the place where a huge amount of deaths took place, usually over a very long period of time. There's also a lot of experimentation, especially in Khrushchev's era, working on different drugs and stuff like that, sodium pentothal, working on truth serums, using that prison population. But because the average Russian industry could not meet the plans that the federal government had laid down, the prison labor was actually a big chunk of the Russian economy. It was a way that they were able to meet quotas when the local factory was not able to. So it was slave labor. It was forced labor. Solzhenitsyn made his whole life based around his experience there and everything else. Yeah, the camp system was far larger than Hitler's system. It was infinitely more deadly, and it lasted for a much longer period of time. But my big problem is that you don't have this social awareness of, let's say, the genocide against the Ukrainians like you have with the Jewish question under Adolf Hitler, which is never ending. And that's my problem with all of this.
Right. Now, would you compare the privatization of prisons in this country with the communist gulag?
I'm not sure how I feel about that. I mean, there's a part of me that says, well, why the heck not? I mean, if they're truly criminals, then why shouldn't they work,
right,
for the good of society? If they're not, then that's another matter. I just think that, the bulk of the concentration camp inmates in the Soviet Union were not criminals. They were there because they were considered unreliable. But as far as the U.S., I'm not prepared to make that kind of a comparison.
Okay.
Yet. In a way, whatever you can do to make a real criminal give back to the society that he's taken from, I'm in favor of it. I really don't care.
Absolutely. But I guess it would depend on who is deciding whether a person is a criminal and what they've been charged with.
I agree. And, I'm no expert on the American justice system, how fair it really is. So I really can't comment on that. I'm going to be agnostic about that question at the moment.
Okay. Now, do you think that the unions and the ability to strike in Russia had an influence on the communist ability to take over?
There's a lot of debate as to what the urban proletarian population actually felt. One of my biggest problems with the typical history of that era is that it's very hard to tell what the average Russian thought he was voting for in the four different Duma bodies, parliamentary bodies that existed under Nicholas II.
Mm-hmm.
I know that the Bolsheviks would simply lie about what they wanted. Their slogan was peace, land, and bread. Now, of course, the peace was one thing. This is in the middle of World War I.
Right.
But land, they're claiming to want to give the peasants land to farm, but of course they didn't believe in private property.
Right.
So that's a lie right there. And they never said anything about persecuting the church, which always remained a very popular institution. So when these people are running, looking for supporters, looking for money, looking for votes, it's difficult to tell what these people were actually voting for. You know, and so the proletarians may have been revolutionary, but I think I would have been too, in the middle of World War One,
right?
And the massive slaughter for no clear reason. I think the Tsar should have just kept out of it, if at all possible.
Right. Now they attempted the Soviets, the Marxists attempted to take over in 1905, and they had sufficient Western money to do that, but they weren't successful. And then they got further money, Jewish money, and were able to take over in the later revolution. Correct?
Well, yeah. It should be noted that in both cases, they needed a war to create a population that is suggestible. 1905-06 was the war against Japan, which was a complete disaster.
Right.
Russia was at such a disadvantage because she had no real advanced communication with the Far East. Port Arthur was not even fortified when the Japanese, with British money and British ships, hit Russian positions in the Far East. There was only one railroad connecting Moscow and Petersburg to the Far East, and that wasn't even finished. So when the Japanese and the Russians met in Port Arthur in New Hampshire, the Japanese admitted that they were completely exhausted, that they were at 100% of their mobilization. Russia maybe was at 10% of their mobilization. But the fact is that in both cases, the press exaggerated the issues of the war. The press exaggerated how bad the war was, and they were making people more susceptible to revolutionary propaganda in both. So in both cases, a war was necessary to make the foundation of the revolution.
Right. And of course, it was the British, again, that went in and armed Japan early on. I think probably by, 1860, 1865, that the Brits approached the Japanese.
Russian expansion in Central Asia and the Far East was rapid. The growth of the Tsarist economy in this period of time is extremely rapid. The peasants were given land, the freedom of the serfs in 1861. Russia was progressing at such a rapid clip that Britain felt threatened. It felt all of its development in Central Asia and East Asia was threatened. So the British did several things. The first was they financed the Russian leftist liberal movement. When Herzen was living in Britain, he was financed by the Rothschild banking clan. They armed the Turkish tribes of Central and Western Asia, and then, as we said, assisted in the rebuilding of the Japanese army and navy on a modern footing. When oil was discovered in the Baku oil fields, that was it.
Right.
If Russia continues this expansion, if Turkey continues to decay, then Russia will take Constantinople again and will create a multi-continental empire, and the British are going to be at a disadvantage. If I could go back in time, I just wish that Germany and Russia would have fought on the same side in World War One together. The tragedy was that they ended up fighting each other. And it seems to me that the anti-English view in both Berlin and St. Petersburg should have bound them together, and it didn't. And that was the real tragedy.
Was that because of the communist infiltration in Germany that helped them to make decisions against Russia? What do you think?
Yeah, that, you know, I'm not 100% sure on that one. I know that the British could not have a German-Russian alliance, that they simply could not handle that. They were willing to give into the Russian position. They were willing to cooperate with Russia in the Balkans, anything to make sure that a Russo-German alliance did not form. If it formed, it would have been the end of the British Empire, in my opinion, or at the very least, would have weakened the British Empire to a great extent.
Right. Now, how do you see the anti-Christian movement, even in the alternative media, having an impact today? Because I notice there are a lot of anti-Christian sentiments. It kind of bothers me.
Well, you know, I've read a lot of these people over the years. Generally speaking, I think that they caricature the faith. They have, you know, they kind of create a straw man. They create this view of the faith that's so ridiculous. They don't understand that so many of their problems and their complaints that they had against the church were dealt with so many centuries ago. I mean, I'm sick and tired of the same complaints coming up again and again and again, and they were dealt with centuries ago. They were dealt with, you know, in the first millennium. These people don't know what the church fathers laid out. They don't know how they understood the faith. They don't know about the relationship between church and state and Constantinople and all the rest of it. I find that I'm frustrated not so much because they're anti-Christian. I'm frustrated because they don't know anything.
Okay.
And I end up having to explain, you know, real basic stuff to them. And you know, they usually end up yelling, and they usually end up starting from the beginning again or some other tactic that they use. I've just found that it's maddening, it's insane, because most of these people simply don't know. And so they create something in their heads, they hate it, they call it Christianity, and that's it.
And aren't these people kind of benefiting the Marxist objective of destroying Christian values?
Well, that's what we kind of said, you know, before, this notion of taking Hegel and turning him or using his method for the sake of a materialist agenda, that was central. I mean, that was Feuerbach, that was Hess, that was Marx.
Right.
Feuerbach's whole you know, famous book, The Essence of Christianity, all of this took from Hegel and tried to make a materialist method out of it. I mean, you know, Hegel was not an atheist in that sense at all. So taking the so-called left Hegelians, taking Hegel and making that method into a materialist justification for materialism, that's where the anti-Christian mentality developed. That's why the Soviets had to liquidate the church as soon as they took over. They knew that this was their main source of opposition, and they knew that the peasants were very much attached to it, and the peasants never made their peace with the Soviet Union. So they went to their deaths in large numbers, especially in Ukraine in the 1930s. So yeah, we're in total agreement on that.
Right. And how do you see that, not just in the alternative media, but how do you see that happening here in this country? Well, I mean, I see it happening with the culture, with the entertainment field, so-called entertainment field, that there's been such a devaluation of Christian values, just in, you know, the law, the divorce rate, the just everything seems to be under attack. Well, Christianity is under attack, plain and simple.
Yeah, we don't disagree on that either. The unfortunate thing is that Christian leaders have a tendency to be a complete disaster area. And, you know, this whole neoconservative Protestant evangelical movement, supporting the war in the Middle East, supporting everything that Israel does, no matter how vile it is. I mean, the miracle is that there are any Christians left at all, given this group of people.
Indeed. This started in like 1809 in London, basically. You know, with the Jewish society and whatnot.
Oh yeah, the Zionism issue. Yeah, I mean it's relatively recent. You need to remember something: the term Israel was something that the Byzantine Empire applied to itself. The first Christian empire, the Greek Orthodox Empire in the Middle East, they called themselves Israel. We are the chosen people of God. The Orthodox Church always referred to itself as the Second Jerusalem, the New Israel. Always, always, always. And only when a memory of that idea began to fade away, somehow Jews were Israel. And so that's the contested word. You know, the Orthodox mind always said that the empire is the continuation of the kingdom of David. We are Israel. And so my problem is that the Jews who rejected Christ call themselves Israel, and I got a problem with that.
Yeah, I do too.
How you get the Protestants, you know, most of the Protestants anyway, you know, backing Israel, you know, and acting as if they're saved by their race, this is outrageous to me.
The fact that they don't actually seem to be reading the New Testament and learning how Christ felt about these people is kind of strange. I mean, if they were really Christian and really relating to the New Testament, why don't they relate to Christ and what he said?
I've come to the conclusion that, generally speaking, the average person that we're talking about here is not interested in the truth of the matter. They're interested in what's in their interest. They're interested in what justifies their pre-existing political point of view. They read and they read and understand only what they want, only what's in the interest of, or so it seems, of the Republican foreign policy establishment. I've debated these people so many times, and I don't think I've gotten anywhere. It's just the same things over and over again. We could quote Christ, we could quote the Talmud until we're blue in the face, and it's not in their interest, so they're not going to believe it. We're on the fringes of society because of this particular point of view, and they would much rather not live there with us, so they're going to reject us. I don't know what to say. I mean, ultimately, I realize that debating and fighting isn't going to convince them. This isn't a rational discussion about what the truth of the matter is, what Christ thought, what he said, what the apostles and their successors thought and said. This is about how I'm to seem mainstream and a harmless individual in modern society, and they'll twist and turn everything to that interest. I think the only thing we can do is treat them with respect, be as kind as possible, lay out what we say in the clearest, non-emotional way, and then if they're going to get all mad and yell and scream, we just walk away.
Right. Do you feel that the churches have been infiltrated or socialized? I think that that this happened probably around the Civil War time, so-called Civil War time, that a lot of the churches were basically in favor of Lincoln invading the South. And I'm thinking, what are these people thinking? And then when you look at their background, you see that they came from a socialist background and that many of them actually came from Europe and came over here and kind of got this, the churches socialized at that point. How do you feel about that?
Well, yeah, me and you agree on that as well. I think the overwhelming majority of churchmen out there right now are useless, that they do more harm than good. They rewrite the Bible, they rewrite the liturgy, they rewrite everything so as to appear harmless to the system. And I'm not sure what else to say about it. I don't think that debating these people has helped us very much. I think that it's just hardened their position all the more. And I don't know what we could do other than what you're doing right now. You lay this stuff out as calmly as you can. You quote from Christ, you quote from the Talmud, you say, do with this what you want, but I'm not going to tolerate you just yelling and screaming and getting all emotional about it. But that just shows you that, they're deluded, and when we start putting pins in that little bubble of theirs, they're going to react and they're going to get angry.
Right. And of course, with the political atmosphere that we have right now, you have Romney coming in who's had a long relationship with Netanyahu, apparently from 1976. And I mean, I don't know where he's coming from. And of course, he was part of the Michigan crime family and has certainly made millions of dollars from exploiting businesses and destroying people's lives. And then on the other side, you have a Marxist who was working for the Jewish interest and pretending they're portraying him as a Muslim. And that certainly will make a lot of people mad. A lot of the population will say, oh, look, he's a Muslim and look what he's doing, when in fact he's always worked for the Jewish interest.
Yeah, I don't really, I'm not following all that closely. I just don't care.
Yeah.
I don't think that politicians have a lot of power. I think that their donors and the big corporations, oil firms and everyone else, Hollywood, who's financing, these are the people who ultimately have the power. Politicians are figureheads. I don't believe that they have their own point of view.
Right.
This is crafted for them by others. I think that the government is largely privatized. It is purely corporate, and I don't know there really isn't much more to say about that. Politicians are figureheads.
Sure.
And I don't think this pageant that happens every 4 years means a whole heck of a lot. Policy has remained exactly the same, no matter whether Obama's been in office or Bush the second has been in office. Policy has remained more or less the same. So it doesn't really, to be honest with you, I don't care.
Right. Well, I don't vote. But certainly, I mean, it's been like that basically since the end of the Civil War.
That changed everything. This creation of a tightly centralized state that came out of that, the destruction of the southern yeoman farmer, And you can't even talk about that. We're trying to say, look, the slaves were only held by a tiny handful of people. The overwhelming number of people who were hurt in the Civil War were non-slave owning poor whites who you don't give a damn about. And you're trying to use slavery and race in this has nothing to do with it, but destroying that culture was able to permit the creation of this centralized industrial state, the state that Alexander Hamilton really wanted and was alone among the founding fathers in wanting that kind of a system.
Right.
But I don't vote either. And the good news about that is that I don't think that we can get drafted for jury duty if we don't vote. I've never seen the inside of a voting booth, I'm proud to say.
Very good.
Yeah, thank you. I've never voted. I've just refused to take part in it because I think it's all phony and it's a charade. Now, if I vote, I'm putting my seal of approval on the system as a whole. But I don't think that we can be called for jury duty if we don't vote. So that's good news anyway.
That is good. Yes. You know, once in a while I do watch Fox News just to see what they're saying. And they are just spending so much time on the different characteristics of the two candidates. And I think this is just some kind of it's a stage play. And they don't talk about any of the real problems. They don't discuss any of the real issues. And people fall for this. They actually fall for this. And that's part of the illusion, is to think that these people have a choice in who their government is, when in fact they don't.
Well, even when you come across these people, it's real easy. You simply say, look, you could pretend that you have an impact when you vote for Congress or president or whatever, but you don't vote for judges. You don't vote for bureaucrats. You don't judge for the corporate lobbyists. You know, you don't vote for any of these people. Fact is that these are the people with the power. And when you know, simply voting on occasion for a politician and therefore you're represented, it's completely absurd. And the people who have the power are not normally up for election one way or another and are pretty camera shy. So, you know, again, the politicians, I don't think, have very much power. And the politics is a matter of trying to analyze where policy comes from and how government work has been privatized, possibly since the Civil War. But for me, I have to say that the final straw was the bailout of the banks, I guess well over $1 trillion by now. And then having to hear Republicans that we don't have money for affordable health care or something else like that. And these people went ahead and helped bail out these people. Many of their top executives were serving in the White House, both under Bush and Obama. And that probably was the last straw where I just came to the conclusion that politics is completely privatized. And if you aren't a billionaire, you are not represented.
Right. And of course, they blamed all of the housing problems on the very people who lost their homes, when in fact it was set up that way. And we never hear about the homelessness. We don't hear about all of the problems. It is just very discouraging, very discouraging.
Well, you know, something new since probably the late 80s or early 90s, where you have middle class and upper middle class people in large numbers losing their homes, that's something relatively new. That's something that's creating a revolutionary cadre out there. I just can't imagine what the mental gymnastics you have to go through is to justify the present system. And the homelessness, I mean, that's the tip of the iceberg. I work at homeless shelters around here and in Pennsylvania, and most of these people are ordinary, you know, halfway well-educated folks.
Right.
And it's unbelievable. And you know, unless you see it with your own eyes, I think a lot of people aren't willing to tell the truth about it. And it's everywhere. And I think, though, the only good news out of all of this is that the average person is going to have to sit down and come up with, you know, what is really important to them. Can we live outside of the system? Can we adopt a totally different point of view than what we have been born and raised with? And I think that as the crisis gets worse and worse, as the state is just more and more disconnected from reality, as more and more money goes into bailouts or the war, I think that the only good thing about that are that people are going to start listening to people like us.
I agree. Now, You are a priest in the Greek Orthodox Old Calendarist Church, correct?
Well, yeah. My canonical authority ultimately comes from the Old Calendar movement amongst the Greek Orthodox Church under Archbishop Auxentius of Athens. I know that that's a lot of labels, but the Old Calendarist movement was an Orthodox tradition that was a strongly medievalist that rejected to a great extent the modern world and much of modern ideology in terms of ethics and ecumenism and things like that. And I found that that group had a tendency to reflect my point of view more than the Orthodoxy remains the most conservative religious group amongst Christians, but there is a faction amongst the so-called New Orthodox that want to kind of keep in step with the times. And so I joined the Old Calendarists as a way to avoid that.
Interesting. I mean, I really had not ever heard of the group until I found your website, listened to your programs. And I thought, well, what is this about? And how did you happen to associate with them? How do you function in that position?
Well, we're in communion with a Russian group, the Russian True Orthodox Church under Metropolitan Raphael of Moscow. He has about 100 parishes in Russia and Ukraine, Belarus. His group was an underground so-called catacomb group during the Soviet Union. Many of the Orthodox people who didn't end up in the camps formed underground churches. In fact, there was an entire network of underground Orthodox churches in the Soviet era. And they're called the Catacomb Christians. And after 1991, they slowly reemerged. Now that they were more or less legal again, they reemerged and began forming kind of a more normal church life. And there are a bunch of these groups out there now. And so the impressive part of it all is that we are in communion with some of these groups who lived an entire church life underground, and including clandestine organizations, even within the Gulag camp system.
That is amazing and quite remarkable.
But there was many thousands of these people throughout the Soviet era. Of course, the other group went into exile and formed the Russian Orthodox Church abroad, which ended up being a very large organization, bringing in many converts from Western backgrounds. And I think a lot of the converts just said, I've had enough. I've had enough with the liberalism from the certain Catholics or certain Episcopalians or whatever it is. And they saw in Orthodoxy a much older, much more traditional approach, and they really feel at home there. So, you know, you still have a problem in America. You have a lot of parishes where they don't speak English and stuff like that. But you have plenty, too, that are not only speaking English, but even using the medieval rites of Western Europe, which no one else does. So my bishop, for example, was one of the translators of the ancient liturgy of York in Northumbria in Britain in the first millennium. And that's what he says. He's the only person in the world who is doing this, you know, absolutely authentic, classic first millennium entire ritual. It would be the Mass and the hours and all the sacraments and everything else are done according to this these ancient documents. So this kind of very traditional Orthodox approach is doing things that no one else wants to do. So it's part of this is all I do. This is my life. This is what I do. This is who I am. And I'm very happy.
Well, that,
despite everything.
That is fascinating. What are your views of Christian identity? What do you think about them?
I've read a few things by them. I think that their history is extremely interesting. I think it's worthy to be discussed. My concept though is that it really doesn't matter. The faith is really all that matters.
Mm-hmm.
In terms of your ethnic or racial background, these things are helpful. These things are important. The Orthodoxy is organized in ethnic organizations, Russian and Greek and Romanian and everything else. I think that that's probably the most sensible way to do it. But if you accept the faith and you're baptized and everything else, then I don't really care what particular backgrounds you have.
Sure.
If you're going to be with us and you're going to think as we do, I don't care. I mean, and who are we? We can't be, beggars can't be choosers anymore. And we're struggling. We're all struggling. And if someone's going to convert and think like we do, then I have nothing to say to them, and I don't really care where they're from or what their ethnic or racial background is.
Sure. All righty. Well, I've certainly enjoyed chatting with you. It's been very educational for me, and I hope that we can do this again.
Well, I really appreciate it. I know what we covered a lot of stuff here, and only in the most superficial way, but I guess what we can hope for is that people will begin to read and study more and start making sense out of all of this stuff, connecting the dots, as it were.
Absolutely. Well, thank you so much.
You're welcome.
All righty. Bye-bye.